there is not a public debate going on right now, and there probably ought to be, if we are even potentially heading to a major confrontation with Iran, a possible military confrontation.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Sharon Weinberger, executive editor for News, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today, and I'm joined by FP Shadow Government contributor John Finer. John was chief of staff to Secretary of State John Kerry and director of policy planning at the State Department. He also spent 4 years in the Obama White House serving as a senior advisor in the Office of the National Security Advisor and the Middle East Advisor. He was previously a reporter for the Washington Post, where he covered conflicts in Iraq, Lebanon, Georgia, and Gaza. Also joining us here today in the studio is Dan DeLuce, FP's chief national security correspondent. And calling in from New York is Kate Brannon, who is the deputy managing editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. ER nerds, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. So today I wanted to talk about Syria, and particularly what looks very much to be like a rapidly escalating war there. Late last week, Dan and Kate, you both published an article about the widening war there, and most importantly, about this internal battle in the White House and the National Security Council about pushing the war over objections from the Pentagon. Dan, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so it is a really volatile situation evolving there, and you have in close proximity U.S. Special Operations Forces, and then their partners on the ground, which are Syrian, Kurdish, and Arab troops that are fighting Islamic State and trying to seize back the city of Raqqa. At the same time, very close by, you have Iranian-backed militia, some Iranian Revolutionary Guard advisors. And what's happened is there's been clashes there where the Iranian-backed militia have entered into areas where the U.S. has asked them not to enter. And while this has been unfolding, that a fierce debate going on behind the scenes, as you mentioned, between some officials in the White House and the National Security Council who see this as a pivotal moment, almost historic, where key geopolitical outcomes are going to happen, and where Iran and the U.S. come down sort of for influence in Iraq and Syria. And they want the U.S. to take a more aggressive stance and actually not just take action when Iranian-backed militia come near special operations forces or the U.S.-backed Kurdish forces, but actually go hunting, as it were, and be much more aggressive. And the Pentagon and the military have mixed feelings about that. And so there was a disagreement, and that kind of hawkish line lost out for the moment. But in the meantime, the situation is volatile. And even without an intent to have a more aggressive approach, you see this conflict between U.S. and Iran and their proxies kind of building.
And it feels very much almost like it's a split within the National Security Council, that there are some very strong personalities driving this policy. Kate, can you tell us a little bit about what was going on there?
Yeah, the two people that Dan and I reported are really pushing this behind the scenes are Ezra Cohen-Watnick, who is the Senior Director for Intelligence on the NSC, and Derek Harvey, who's a retired colonel, a protege of retired General David Petraeus, worked with him in Iraq. Both of them are sort of leftovers from when Michael Flynn was the National Security Advisor not that long ago, before H.R. McMaster got the job. And these guys were handpicked by Flynn. Flynn was also very hawkish on Iran. And McMaster early on, at least we know with Cohen-Watnick, he tried to move him to another job. There's some sense that he's not well trusted by the intelligence community. He's viewed as inexperienced. I think he's 31 years old. He's in charge for the NSC of all covert ops. So these two guys behind the scenes are, who I've heard from sources, are the ones driving this, that are very hawkish on it. And Dan and I, we didn't get a clear sense of where McMaster himself fell on this. It's not clear if he sides with Secretary Mattis on it, or if he, in fact, might be more in line with Harvey and Cohen-Watnick. He has had his own kind of run-ins with them. They have tried to go around him at times, McMaster, that is. So that piece of it's not clear. So in terms of the internal NSC divisions, I don't have as much sort of insight into that as I do about sort of the interagency battle over this. And as we reported too, Brett McGurk, who's the State Department czar on the counter-ISIS fight, he also is very much in line with Mattis and wants to keep it narrowly focused on the ISIS fight and not sort of open up a new front against these Iranian proxies in the Assad regime.
John, is this normal? I mean, certainly in all administrations, you have divisions among agencies, but to have a 31-year-old or any person on the National Security Council trying to sort of back end the process or going around the National Security Advisor, is that normal?
Well, so I think, as you indicated, there are always these divisions, especially on areas of policy that are so consequential and where the stakes are so high. We certainly had divisions over some of the policy decisions made during the Obama administration. So to me, that is not the fundamental problem. I think the more fundamental problem is that this is a relatively narrow, actually, I think, disagreement in a broader context of escalation that is taking place, not just in Syria and Iraq, but throughout the region, even beyond the region. And just taking a half step back for a second, I think we didn't know much about Donald Trump's foreign policy when he came to office, but we did know a few things. We knew that he was wanting to get tougher with Iran and didn't think the Obama administration had been tough enough. We knew that he wanted to get tougher with ISIS, and we didn't know exactly what he meant by that. But he also kept saying over and over again that he didn't want major military interventions in the Middle East. He called them quagmires. Something had to give, given all those goals and the tension among them. And it seems like what has given so far is his aversion to intervention. And so now what you're seeing in Syria, as Dan and Kate's story laid out so effectively, is exactly the sort of escalation that he'd said he was not going to support.
How much do you think that's driven by his appointment of military officers to some of these key posts, Homeland Security and the Pentagon?
So I think there's a range of factors. One element of this is not just the appointment of senior, either recently retired or currently active duty military officers to roles that traditionally go to civilians, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of Homeland Security, but also stacking the senior ranks of the National Security Council staff, which is normally made up of some diplomats, some intelligence professionals, and some military officers, with a much higher percentage than is standard of military officers. So when you're getting that particular form of advice, I think policy issues can tend to be framed in a particular way that casts things in military terms. And when you add that to what has been so far, at least, a real de-emphasis of diplomacy, you know, signaled through the desire to slash the State Department's budget and the failure to appoint senior people to almost every consequential position in the State Department, you do start to see an indication that he values one set of policy options and one form of advice over others.
Dan, what happened to this great plan to defeat the Islamic State? I mean, it was sort of staffed. I mean, how much does that play into what's going on now? What happened to the plan?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think some of these more so-called hawks in the National Security Council that Kate's referring to are much more focused on Islamic State, on Iran than Islamic State. The Islamic State, you don't hear about that much lately. And I think that's a result, actually, of some success on the battlefield, right? So over the past year, even before Trump was inaugurated, you saw ISIS losing ground, losing territory in Iraq, in Syria, and they've been steadily losing their hold on a lot of this territory. Now Raqqa is sort of their last urban bastion. It doesn't mean they're going to be gone, but it does mean that territory is opening up, and that as a result, we're seeing a bit of a free-for-all. And that's Iran sees and the Syrian regime sees an opportunity to kind of assert control over these areas that Islamic State is losing. And that hence you have this kind of discussion going on in the White House and between the White House and the Pentagon. It's also something worth pointing out that this could easily be happening to another president. These events were in train before Trump was inaugurated. There were special operations forces deployed to Syria, deployed to Iraq. You know, the war against ISIS kept kind of escalating. And meanwhile, you had this decision that was almost not quite taken, but almost taken at the closing weeks of Obama's presidency, which is we're going to arm the Syrian Kurds and we're going to take back Raqqa and we'll figure out what happens afterward.
So is Trump doing anything different than the Obama administration or a Clinton administration or any administration would have done in this position?
I'm sure John will have something to say. I think the answer would be yes and no. It's hypothetical, but I think in some ways, there's no question the military has fewer checks on it and fewer questions and less oversight, so they are more ready to take action, move on in tactical situations faster and use force maybe with less pause and less consideration. And then also, I think it is true that diplomacy, it's unclear if diplomacy has a place at the table in the White House right now on any given issue, whatever it is, especially in this situation where you have a war, you have combat on the ground, events unfolding. And so you have these kind of immediate tactical moves to make. So, for example, the Defense Secretary Mattis, much less Trump, are not sitting around approving these airstrikes that are happening. So when the Iranian-backed militia ventures close in to this area where these U.S. Special Operations Forces are in southeastern Syria, it's just automatic. The commanders on the ground call for the airstrike. So I think in some ways, President Clinton could have been faced with a similar situation. We don't know how she and her aides would have responded, but I think it is an interesting kind of question to pose.
John, do you have some speculation on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm with the caveat that I may not be the most impartial person to assess this.
That's fine.
I think there are at least four pretty significant differences to how this administration is handling this same very difficult, admittedly, problem set to how the Obama administration had. It's hard to speculate how another administration would. One is what Dan alluded to, which is a major delegation of authority to make tactical decisions on the ground by military commanders, but decisions that can have strategic level consequences. These are not coming back to Washington for review. There was, I will acknowledge, some frustration during the Obama era, you know, that too many of these decisions had to be debated by the National Security Council, by the deputies, by the principals. It took too much time. People felt like the White House was sometimes meddling in decisions that commanders could make. But the other side of that coin is you now have commanders making decisions that can have big significant strategic level consequences without these decisions having oversight from Washington, which can cause problems. The second is a total lack of transparency about some of what is going on. And I think that is actually a pretty significant difference. The Obama administration did not deploy troops to these regions without telling the press that it was doing so and giving some indication of locations and numbers, even if it wasn't down to the grid coordinate, because there are operational security reasons why you want to be careful. These decisions now are not only being delegated, they're not being discussed. They're not being discussed in the White House and the State Department press briefings, and I think that's a big problem as well. Third is what Dan mentioned, which is just a lack of focus on diplomacy to try to end these conflicts. You know, the Obama administration's theory was there were times when you needed to push and escalate and provide assistance to the people who you were backing in a conflict or other. But in the context where you were also trying to use diplomacy to end the conflict, using the leverage that you got from force to try to achieve a diplomatic outcome. No sense that there are diplomatic outcomes on the table here. And fourth, and I think you can't overstate this enough, there is actually a desire by this administration to confront Iran. Even the people who don't want Iran to get in the way of the counter-ISIL fight, people like General Mattis, who Dan discussed earlier, these are people who for a number of years now have believed the United States needed to take Iran on more aggressively. The Obama administration approach was push back on Iran, but also engage Iran. These guys are not talking to Iran at a high level. Secretary Tillerson said as much when he was in Riyadh. And there is a desire, even among the so-called adults in the room who restrain some of the worst impulses potentially of the president, to take Iran on more directly.
Could I jump
in?
Yeah, please. Those are good points. And further along those lines, you know, your old boss, John Kerry, had a direct line, speed dial just about, to the Iran foreign minister. And he sometimes took heat for it. But there was a channel there. And when there was a crisis, he could pick up the phone and talk to Zarif because of the whole negotiations and the relationship they developed in the nuclear negotiations. So for example, when those Navy sailors were captured, he could get on the phone and with his Iranian counterpart and get him released within hours.
Within 24 hours that time. And you do wonder if a similar incident happened today, both how long it might take to resolve and what other escalation might take place before it was resolved.
Okay, I'm curious. I mean, as part of that, you know, we've seen this sort of escalating confrontation with Iran right now just through things like shoot downs of Iranian drones. Do you, from the people you speak to, do you have a sense that the administration has a plan for how it wants to deal with Iran in the Syrian context? I mean, what happens when the Islamic State does fall? What then?
Well, Dan reported as part of our story that there is this broader Iran strategy review going on, and I think that it, in a larger context, is, you know, this debate about this particular issue in Syria is just much larger when it comes to the bigger Iran strategy. But one thing I wanted to say, and a little bit of backstory on the reporting, but today the Washington Post had a story that largely confirmed everything we reported on Friday. It included new details that are important. It also included the White House perspective. We offered them the opportunity to comment on our story, and they didn't respond. But they clearly did participate with the Washington Post. So you have the White House's framing of the issue, and I found it fascinating because the way I think that they're talking about it is that this is the inevitable next chapter of the war in Syria, as if there's no choice in the matter, that after you defeat ISIS, obviously you next go to war with Assad and Iran. And I don't think that struck me as, I mean, I never heard that when I was reporting on the Obama Pentagon or the Obama White House. And I don't think the American public is fully aware that that's the next chapter of the war and that it's an inevitability. So I think that that said a lot about what this White House wants to do.
And the White House had been, I mean, your story hit a nerve with them. They had pushed back pretty hard. What do you think they found so upsetting about it?
I think we named names, number one. We identified the people who are pushing this policy. We identified the disagreement with the Pentagon. We said that Mattis had shot down these proposals. We made that public. In the Washington Post story, it was clear the White House really wanted to downplay the disagreement with the Pentagon. They made it sound like they're on the same page, basically. I think that that's not entirely true.
John, yeah, do you think they're on the same page?
It would appear from the reporting to be not the case, but they don't consult me on these things, so hard for me to say definitively.
Dan, what do you think? I'm curious what Dan thinks about why they...
I think
why
you
they
nailed
played
it.
Us like that.
I think you nailed it right on the head. I don't think there's anything more to add. I think, I would say stay tuned. I'm not worried about that story. Other reporting as well as the Washington Post has been on the same lines. But this is a really important point Kate's making, though, which is there is not a public debate going on right now, and there probably ought to be, if we are even potentially heading to a major confrontation with Iran, a possible military confrontation. There's always this talk about, you know, we're going to get tough on Iran. And you've heard there's a lot of political rhetoric in domestic U.S. politics about that, right? And we heard it during the campaign from Trump, you know, I'm not going to be weak on Iran. But again, what does that mean? And the administration actually is not sure what it means. If you speak to them, you get different answers, as this reporting and these articles point out. So, for example, does it mean that you widen sanctions against Iran? Does it mean you indirectly over time sabotage the nuclear agreement with Iran? Does it mean that you actually seek military confrontation in southern Syria on the belief that you must prevent Iran from getting some kind of a bridgehead on the Iraq border?
Well, if we're generous, what is the, I mean, if in the sense of saying that, yes, they have some sort of strategy, what is that? Simply to keep Iran contained, or
I think that is
something more drastic or radical?
I think that is the question, and I don't think they have answered it themselves. And actually, when I've spoken to them privately, they say we're still engaged in this really broad review, and that is true. And the review is taking into account, how do we check Iran's influence? It starts with the premise that Iran's influence is dangerous, malign is the word that's always used, and that it's spreading across the region, that they have become supposedly emboldened. And so Iran has become somehow more dangerous because of Syria. So if you speak to the Israeli government, they see Iran and its proxies, Hezbollah and these different Shiite militia spread across Syria, and it makes them very nervous. So that's Israel's point of view. And I think some of these officials in the White House share that view. And so the question then is, and then they look at Yemen, and they get very worried about Iran's support for the Houthi rebels. Of course, the counter to that is, well, maybe if Saudi Arabia stopped bombing Houthi communities and towns, that maybe the situation wouldn't be aggravated so much. But anyway, there's this idea that somehow Iran's influence and power has to be checked and countered and pushed back by various means. And it even comes down to even in other issues like Iranian Americans who are held in Iran, Siam Akhnamazi, this Iranian American, that's even on their list. So they see this very broad kind of list of concerns and problems that have to be addressed somehow, almost like it's going to be a kind of Cold War strategy or something.
The other thing I think that we've seen with the Trump administration is they've lumped these Iranian militia and, you know, Hezbollah which the U.S. considers a terrorist group, but they've lumped them in with Islamic terrorism, which I think is new. I think up until now, the American public has understood that to mean al-Qaeda and all of its offshoots, whether that's the Islamic State or Boko Haram, you know, these Sunni jihadist groups that are intent on attacking the U.S. at home and abroad. And now I think that the Trump administration, we saw this in his speech in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, is now including Iranian groups in that, which is a big shift.
I think that's a very interesting point. And I also think that Dan's note that there should be a public debate about this topic is absolutely critical. A conversation like you're hearing right now should be taking place not just between the administration and the press pool that covers it. It should also be taking place in Congress. And this raises the question of if the administration does intend a quote-unquote second war after the defeat of ISIS against these Iranian-backed militias and the Syrian regime, under what legal authority would it be conducting that conflict? Right now, they are conducting the conflict against the Islamic State under a 2001 authorization for the use of military force against al-Qaeda. And ISIS, as a sort of derivative or offshoot of al-Qaeda, the legal theory goes, is covered by that 2001 authorization for the use of military force. There is no plausible way, not speaking as a lawyer, but I'd invite other lawyers to comment on this, no plausible way, I don't think, that they could extend that 2001 authorization for the use of military force to go to war with Syria or go to war with Iran, which, as bad as we believe them to be, and they are quite bad, they're not aligned with or affiliated with al-Qaeda. They're not a derivative.
So would they have to seek a new authorization to do that?
The way our system tends to work is that they would and that they should. The problem is that Congress has not demonstrated much of an ability really to legislate about anything of this magnitude and of this consequence, but particularly they have tried a number of times to update that 2001 AUMF in the context of ISIS, let alone taking on an AUMF for a bigger, broader war against potentially two nation states. I'm not optimistic that they would be able to pull that off.
How does Russia figure into this at all, Dan? Because it seems like you need some sort of cooperation with Russia in any sort of whatever comes out in Syria. But at the same time, you have an administration that's also under investigation for its contacts with Russia. How has that affected things? I mean, sure it has. I mean, everyone's sort of scared to pick up the phone and talk to Russia now.
That's right. In terms of diplomacy, it is very problematic. They're in a bind. If you could, we do another thought experiment. Let's say someone else was president. You would have to consider Russia to be potentially part of any solution in Syria. If there's any way to diffuse, contain, or even resolve the conflict, or at least even just resolve these tense incidents in southern Syria, you need to come to some kind of understanding with Russia. Russia is supporting the Syrian regime. You somehow would have to have some kind of diplomatic outreach. And of course, John Kerry tried that. Didn't go very far. The Russians weren't really ready to play ball. They kind of felt like they were winning on the ground. John can add it, can join it, can tell us what he thinks. But now you know, the question is, how much room does the Trump White House have to maneuver when they're under so much scrutiny because of all the questions about what the Trump campaign said or what they were doing with the Russians during the election campaign. And then on top of that, the Senate has tied their hands potentially because they've just adopted this very aggressive sanctions bill that codifies the sanctions that were imposed just before Trump took office. Now we'll see what the House does. But that again would limit their room to maneuver with Russia when they would have to go to Congress to get some sanctions removed. So when it comes to Syria, whatever the U.S. asks of Russia, the answer I would assume from Moscow ultimately would be, well, you lift those sanctions and maybe we can, you know, cut a deal in Syria. I'm simplifying it, but I think it does kind of come down to that in the end.
John, do you agree? Is that handicapped this administration quite a bit?
I think it's a big challenge. Look, Russia is not pleasant or easy to deal with diplomatically, speaking from experience. I mean, we did, as Dan mentioned, spend a lot of time negotiating with the Russians, not just in the context of Syria, but on Ukraine, in the Iran nuclear deal. These guys are tough and they are difficult. But recap for people, in September of 2015, Russia launched a major military intervention into Syria. There is a significant number of Russian forces on the ground and a lot of Russian military equipment, including jets and other big ticket items that are there protecting the Assad regime. So the notion that you are going to be able to resolve the conflict in Syria without dealing directly at least on some level, with the Russians, we always thought was pretty far-fetched. So while we did not believe that there was a tremendously high likelihood of achieving a diplomatic success with the year-long process that we embarked on with the Russians and other countries to try to resolve the Syrian war, we thought the war had gotten bad enough with several hundred thousand deaths and millions of people displaced internally and abroad. And we thought that Russia was deeply involved enough that there was really no alternative. And we were willing to risk failure, which is where this ended up, to see if there was a shot to try to end this horrific conflict.
So final question. We started off talking about how these divisions within the administration was playing out. Who, Kate, do you think is going to win this battle? Will it be the Pentagon? Will it be Mattis? Will it be sort of the former Flynn people on the National Security Council? What do you expect to see happen?
It's a really good question. I think part of the thing to watch is who keeps their job, and I'm quite serious about that.
Who's not indicted?
Outside the Russia investigation, I think there are, through my reporting, it's clear that there are factions of the White House that are gunning for McMaster. You know, I've wondered how Mattis stays so independent and away from all of this drama that goes on inside the White House. I think part of it is because he is literally outside of it. He's over in Virginia at the Pentagon. But I've been told, you know, after McMaster, like Mattis is next, that the same people that don't like the adults in the room, quote unquote, don't like Mattis's influence. He's getting in the way of what they want to do. So I think keeping an eye on literally who has job security is important in this debate. At the same time, these Iran hawks, you know, there have been moves to get them off to diminish their influence. So that's kind of the thing that I'm watching in terms of the larger debate and who wins the day.
Dan?
Yes, that is yet another impossible question. I think Kate's right. I don't think they don't know the people in the turf battle, but I would not underestimate Mattis. He does have a lot of influence. He has tremendous kind of support in Congress as well. And it would be extremely damaging if the turf battles and power struggles escalated to the point where he felt he couldn't put up with it anymore and left. I think even just the threat of his resignation would get the president's attention. And if he actually went through with it, I think it'd be very damaging. I don't think we're at that point yet. But if the turf wars and the dysfunction, you know, kind of continued, we could face that. And then back to Russia, I think that's something to watch.
We always get back to Russia.
Yeah, because really, if things were to get much worse around southeastern Syria, around El Tanf, if, for example, you know, what if U.S. forces are killed by Iranian-backed militia in an incident or captured or something in reverse, you know, a full kind of pitched battle breaks out between Iran's proxies and U.S. proxies. In the end, they would be picking up the phone to Moscow, I think, to try to solve it because the relations with Tehran are so kind of non-existent.
I think that's an important point, which is that we can debate how the administration might be choosing to set its strategy as it deliberates in real time. But the reality is this may not be up to us at the end of the day. There can be events that transpire that will create a momentum of their own, especially in a context of already heightened tension, already heightened escalation. And with a president who learned, I think, from the Tomahawk strikes that he did on Syria, that when you flex your muscles as the president of the United States, particularly militarily, at least in the short term, you tend to be rewarded by the Washington establishment that watches these things very closely. People applauded that step. And I think that lesson may prove instructive to how he responds going forward. And to Dan's point about Mattis, I'm a lot less worried about him resigning or threatening to resign than I am about him becoming essentially the salesman for this bigger intervention. I think once the ISIS fight is out of the way, and we may be pretty close to that, matter of months before certainly Raqqa is taken and then Deir ez-Zor, and then we're pretty much out of the woods, at least for the big pieces of the ISIS fight. I'm worried that then someone like Mattis, who again has wanted for a number of years, and it's important to remember this, to take on Iran, becomes the one going to the Hill with a lot more credibility than others in this administration to say this is something that we need to do. And I think the real wild card here is sort of the quiet person of this administration, who by all accounts has a lot of influence with Trump, but is not tremendously vocal publicly. So it's hard to know where he stands on these things, and that's Tillerson. You know, I have, as a former State Department person, held out a lot of hope for Secretary Tillerson. I think when he was named, there were a lot of us in the department, both career and political officials, who thought, well, that's a credible choice and a comforting choice in many ways. And I think so far we're still waiting for those hopes to be fulfilled and realized.
I was going to make the same point as John, that exactly that as much as we could discuss these policy debates, it's the situation on the ground is moving faster than the Trump White House is making decisions. But I also think that the situation is moving so quickly because of that unpredictability out of Washington. I think that other actors are sort of, they know that there's room to give, that there's something to test. It's completely unclear what the U.S. would do. So I think that that's part of what we're watching play out.
And do you have a thought on that, or the idea of Mattis as either the salesman of the Iran war or sort of the check and the balance, where he might come down?
While John was talking, I was thinking about how the White House is keen to make these military men who have so much credibility be their salesmen. I think we're seeing that with McMaster and Afghanistan. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see that here, I guess.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen. Thank you. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, John. Thanks, Kate. Thank you for joining us on the ER. Please tune in next time. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sharon Weinberger, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori. For more information about FP and to subscribe to The ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.